Yeah, so when Shubha asked me to give this talk last week, I said yes. And I said yes because it's part of, at the moment, I'm practicing going beyond my personal preferences. One of which is not giving talks. So it's just a really strong spiritual practice. And I don't know why I don't like giving talks, but it's never been something that I've really enjoyed doing or liked doing. But the subject of Kalyana Mitratar is close to my heart, and so I thought, well, I'd like to share a few thoughts about it with you. So I'm going to be talking about it, the theory of it, and also about the practice of it. So the theory hopefully won't be too dry, and the practice hopefully will be very exciting and interesting. But anyway, I first of all I thought I'd define the terms Kalyana Mitratar. Shubha gave one of the associations and meanings of my name, which is my name. Kalyana is part of my name, so I'm very familiar with its meaning. One of its meanings is beautiful. Another is ethical. Another is auspicious. And another is spiritual. And Mitratar simply means friendship. So Kalyana Mitratar means not only spiritual friendship, but all these other associations are also included. So a Kalyana Mitra is a spiritual friend. So some of you here, I have no idea about the class and who's in it, but some of you might not know what a mitra is. Is that the case? Does everybody know what a mitra is? No. I'm glad somebody doesn't know. Okay. I'm assuming others of you are mitras, and so you might be wondering what a mitra is, not to speak of a Kalyana mitra. So I thought I would give a bit of background history here about what a mitra is and how they came about, as it were. So when Sangharakshita founded the FWBO, which was what Tri Ratna used to be called, in 1967, the F in FWBO stood for friends. And a friend was anybody that came along and participated in any of our activities. So I started off as a friend in 1974. But also in that year, he decided to introduce what became known as the Mitra system. Some of you might have heard of this. And Mitra is a Sanskrit word meaning friend. So Mitrata means friendship. So a Mitra is a friend. So in order to distinguish a friend with capital F from Mitra, he brought in the idea that if somebody wanted to commit themselves more to the spiritual life, to their practice, they could become a Mitra. But they could only become a Mitra if they could find two order members who would be prepared to be their Kalyana Mitra, or spiritual friend. So this was pretty difficult because there was hardly any order members. And loads of people wanted to become mitras. So that system didn't work very well. In fact, I don't think it worked for very long. But it was the start of a kind of more of a formalising system, so that there was built into our community right from the start almost, this idea of friendship as part of the path, as part of the spiritual path, as part of the spiritual life. And in the early days of our Sangha, and Sangharakshita had got experience, not very much experience, of Buddhism in Britain, because he came back from India where he'd been living for about 20 odd years, to Britain. He'd been invited back to Britain by the then British Buddhist establishment. And he soon realised that friendship wasn't even on the cards at all. People didn't seem to make friends. They didn't even publicly admit to being Buddhists. And this seemed to be the done thing in British Buddhist circles at the time. It seems a bit hard to read. I mean, I can't understand how that could possibly be the case. But anyway, so it was the case, and he thought that spiritual friendship was so important that it's become one of the main distinctive emphases of the Tri Ratna movement. So these days it's a lot easier to become a Mitra, you'll be glad to hear, those of that aren't and that might want to be. And I think that's really great, actually, that it's much easier to become a Mitra. My own story was quite a long one. It took me 3 attempts to become a Mitra, because I don't know why that was, but anyway, at the 3rd time of asking, I became a Mitra. And you have a special ceremony. Some of you may have been at the centre when there's been Mitra ceremonies, usually on a festival day. So I became a Mitra in 1980, and I was on my own, the only one to do it. And it was on Sangha Day, so it was lovely. Really enjoyed it. I invited lots of my friends. I didn't know that wasn't the sort of thing you did in those days. I sent them all cards. I was so excited. And all these non-Buddhist friends turned up at the centre. It was quite interesting. Anyway, I became a Mitra at last. I was really pleased. But I never managed to have formal Kalyana Mitras in all the years that I've been practicing. I have many, many Kalyana Mitras, but they're not formal Kalyana Mitras. So I'll just explain a bit about that. A formal Kalyana Mitra is someone who really takes you on in a very personal kind of way. And there is a ceremony that you go through with your 2 Kalyana Mitras, and it's a private ceremony. It's not public like the ordinary Mitra ceremony. It's private. And I believe Anne's going to have hers soon. I think in 2 weeks, is that right? Yeah. So she's going to be going through that ceremony with 2 very close friends, and they will be her Kalyana Mitras, formally. So a Mitra can still ask 2 order members to become their Kalyana, to become her Kalyana Mitra. Yeah. And usually that happens when a Mitra decides that they want to commit even further to their spiritual practice. And often it happens around about the time that they ask for ordination or that they're approaching the ordination. Sometimes it happens after they get ordained. So it's quite interesting that order members still can do the ceremony as well if they want to, once they're ordained. So I think that Sangharakshita introduced this system because he saw the importance of spiritual friendship. And it wasn't, as I said, at the time, it wasn't really emphasised at all. And yet, when you read the Pali scriptures, when you read the Mahayana scriptures, there's a lot of references to spiritual friendship and how important it is. And I think at one point the Buddha even says to his companion and friend and attendant Ananda that it's the whole of the spiritual life. So that's quite a statement, isn't it? That the whole of the spiritual life can be contained within spiritual friendship. That is a pretty strong statement by the Buddha, the enlightened one. So there's a story in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Chula Gusinga Sutta, and it's from the Pali Canon. And it's a story of three friends who live together practicing the Dharma. And I think it's a really beautiful example of spiritual friendship in a quite high degree of spiritual friendship. And it's a really moving and profound story. And when I first came across this text, I was working in a team-based right livelihood in West London called Friends Foods, which was an organic, vegetarian, whole food shop in the days before such things were very popular. And we had a little shrine in our basement staff room, and on that shrine I put a copy of this sutra because it inspired me so much that I wanted that sutra to be within the fabric of our business. So I thought I would read you from the actual text just the first part of the story, and you'll see, or hopefully you'll see, the importance of it. So this is the Chula Gusinga Sutta, the shorter discourse in Gusinga. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Nadika in the brick house. Now on that occasion, the Venerable Aniruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbala were living at the park of the Gusingasala tree wood. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to the park of the Gusingasala tree wood. The park keeper saw the Blessed One coming in the distance and told him, "Do not enter this park, recluse. There are three clansmen here seeking their own good. Do not disturb them." The Venerable Aniruddha heard the park keeper speaking to the Blessed One and told him, "Friend park keeper, do not keep the Blessed One out. It is our teacher, the Blessed One, who has come." Then the Venerable Aniruddha went to the Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbala and said, "Come out, venerable sirs, come out. Our teacher, the Blessed One, has come." Then all three went to meet the Blessed One. One took his bowl and outer robe, one prepared a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready and washed his feet. Then those three venerable ones paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. When they were seated, the Blessed One said to them, "I hope you are all keeping well, Aniruddha. I hope you are all comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food." "We are keeping well, Blessed One. We are comfortable, and we are not having any trouble getting alms food." "I hope, Aniruddha, that you are all living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." "Surely, venerable sir, we are living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." "But, Aniruddha, how do you live thus?" "Venerable sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is great gain for me, that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards these venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards those, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind." the Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbala each spoke likewise, adding, "That is how, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." And there's another translation which says, "viewing each other with eyes of affection," which I love as well. This is a different translation. Anyway, that's the start of the story, and it goes on from that. And eventually you realise that these three young chaps are pretty far advanced along the path, because the Buddha starts asking them about their meditation practice. And, you know, when they start telling them about these fantastic states of meditation they get into, and in fact you might even suspect that they might even be enlightened. So it's a pretty high ideal that that they're living like this. But it's actually very human as well, isn't it? The Buddha comes along and talks to them just as friends, in a way, and he's really concerned about them. He asks about whether they're, you know, in good health, which probably wasn't an easy thing in those days, because they were all wandering and living in the open air in the forest. They were living in a grove, a Gasinga sal tree grove, and they lived by begging. So, you know, alms food was a big deal. So if you didn't get any alms food, you know, you'd be starving. So the Buddha is concerned about their physical and you know, their physical condition and their health, and whether they're actually okay. So, and this is what our friends are like as well, our spiritual friends. Our normal friends that aren't even spiritual friends should be concerned about our health and our well-being. So a spiritual friend, in a way, is an ordinary friend, but it's a friend that you share a common ideal with, that you share a common aspiration with. So these three friends were living together, and they obviously had a common aspiration of becoming enlightened like the Buddha, becoming awake like the Buddha. So I think that's a really interesting story. And it's a real example, I think, of putting yourself aside and going beyond personal preferences. So being receptive, as Shubha said earlier, being receptive is one of the real things that you need to be able to do, to have a spiritual friend and to be a spiritual friend. So you could say that these are an example, these chats are an example of what the Venerable Sangharakshita came to call horizontal spiritual friendship. So you can imagine they're all kind of peers, they're all roughly at the same level of spiritual development. So he coined this phrase, horizontal spiritual friendship, to exemplify that. And he also talks about vertical spiritual friendship, where you're friends with someone who's further along the path. Yeah. And there's another story from the Udana, also in the Pali Canon, which is early Buddhism, early Buddhist scriptures, which illustrates this idea of vertical spiritual friendship. And this is the story of Meghiya. Now, I didn't have an Udana, so I'm going to have to tell you the story from memory. And in this story, the Buddha and Meghiya is his attendant at the time, and they're by themselves. They're walking along in the forest, as usual. And Meghiya seems to be a youngish chap, and he spots a beautiful mango grove off to one side. And he thinks, oh, that'd be a fantastic place to go and meditate. I'm just going to ask the Buddha if I can just pop off there and meditate. And the Buddha says to him, Well, really, Megia, I would really rather that you didn't do that and that you stayed with me until some other people come along that can be, you know, be my attendant, because he's the only attendant the Buddha's got at the time. So Megia is not very happy about that, and he says, well, it's all right for you to talk. I mean, I don't know if he said it in quite those words. I mean, you're the enlightened one, you know. You don't have to do any more work. You've done all you... you don't have to meditate anymore and blah, blah. I need to go and meditate in that mango grove so that I can... so that I can become enlightened. So the Buddha said, well, what can I say to you, Megia? If you talk about striving towards enlightenment, off you go then. So he does. He plunges off into this delightful mango grove and goes to meditate. But guess what? He can't meditate. He's beset by all these distractions and difficulties, and he can't concentrate at all. So after a while, he goes back to the Buddha and says, I'm really surprised at what happened to me. All these distractions started to come up and I couldn't meditate. So then the Buddha says to him, and I've got a quote from the Udana. I didn't have the whole thing, but I've got a quote. The Buddha says to him that when you are still not, when you're still quite a beginner, really, when he talks about the heart's release being immature, which is probably his kind way of saying you're not very well advanced along the path, Megia. What you need, the first thing that you need, is the companionship of good people. You need spiritual friendship. And then the Buddha goes on to list the benefits that can be expected of a person that has spiritual friends. So, he says, I'll just quote this part. And he talks about a monk, but you can pretend it's person, because he's talking to monks. Now, Megia, a monk who has spiritual friendship can be expected to become virtuous. He will keep to his vows. He will practice ethical behaviour. He will see danger even in small faults. He will train himself in the precepts. Also, Megia, a monk who has spiritual friendship will be surrounded by talk that is serious about meditation, insight and liberation. And again, Megia, a monk who has spiritual friendship, can be expected to be firm and energetic in abandoning what is unskillful and acquiring what is skillful. And finally, Megia, a monk who has spiritual friendship, can be expected to develop the penetrating insight that leads to the end of suffering. So here you have quite a pithy summation of the benefits of having spiritual friends, and it can lead to the end of suffering. So it can, the Buddha's saying here, spiritual friendship is really important to your spiritual life. So we need spiritual friendship to grow spiritually. It's absolutely vital. It's a really important part of our spiritual life. And I think you'd have to be quite extraordinary as an individual to be able to practice on your own without any help. I mean, the Buddha was such an individual. I mean, how would we even have discovered Buddhism if it hadn't been for others? And so many people have made so many efforts throughout the years. There wouldn't be any translations of Buddhist scriptures. And there wouldn't be anybody to make any sense of them for us. There wouldn't be any Triratna. There wouldn't be any city centres, no retreat centres, no meditation teachers. No teachers of ethics, nothing. So how on earth would we even begin to practice? that we'd be so, so difficult. We just take it all for granted that these things exist. But they only come about because people cared enough to share and to work and to make it possible for other people to practice. And I certainly wouldn't have got to where I've got in my practice without my friends. And as Shubha said earlier, I mean, I have really embraced this as a practice, spiritual friendship. I've worked in spiritual, I've lived in spiritual communities. I've worked in team-based right livelihoods. I've tried to build a Buddhist centre myself. And I remember Sangharakshita saying once, I can't remember where he said it, but he says that what you need to build a Buddhist movement isn't bricks and mortar. It's not even money. What you need is people. That's what you need. People. People that are committed to the same vision that you're committed to. It's really... That's really all you need. So, and that in more traditional Buddhist language is people that have gone for refuge to the three jewels, that have committed themselves to the ideals of Buddhism. So I wouldn't have got anywhere without my spiritual friends. My first teacher who taught me to meditate was Subhuti. So some of you might know Subhuti, he's our president here. And in those days, we were both in our 20s, so you can imagine, a lot younger than we are now. But Subhuti, even then, was an exceptional teacher. And it wasn't even so much what he said to me that inspired me. It was more the way he was. And there was something indefinable, I don't know, I couldn't really pin it down. There was something indefinable about how he was in his own being that really attracted me. And I wanted what he had, but I didn't know how to get it. So it was just really attractive, that quality. And I think it is a quality of spiritual friendship that it attracts people. So it's very interesting that. So if it hadn't been for me going along to learn meditation, not even at a Buddhist centre, this was at the City Lit in London, where Subhuti was running a Buddhism and meditation course, I just got really inspired by that. And it was also my own experience a long time later when I was ordained, and the first flush of ordination, I was really inspired. And I was living at Tara Loka and I wanted to put on retreats for beginners, complete beginners, whole week long retreats. And up until then, we'd only done weekends because we didn't think people would come for a week. We thought, you know, a weekend was probably the most that a newcomer would want to do. Anyway, I was determined, so we started running these retreats called New Directions. And they were just amazing retreats. And what was great about them was the teams of people that were got together to run them. And you may well have had experience of being on a retreat run by a team of friends and seeing those friends working together is really inspiring. And of course, I didn't know this at the time, but afterwards, what people would say, they wouldn't remember a thing about what you'd taught them about the Dharma. Not a word, wouldn't remember anything. But what they remembered was seeing how the team worked together. And that was what inspired them. It wasn't our attempts to communicate the Dharma. It was the friendship that really inspired them and attracted them. And that was my own experience as well. So it's quite interesting. So it was actually from those retreats that I decided I needed to have a book because I thought, well, you can only get so many people onto one retreat. I think we had 28 was our maximum. But if I wrote a book or edited a book, then more and more women would maybe catch the ideas of Buddhism and the ideals of Buddhism and friendship that are in the book. Unfortunately, no longer in print, so you can't buy a copy. But I think there is one. Is that from the library, that copy?
No, it's mine.
Oh, it's your copy. Shubha's got a copy. Yeah, no longer. It was published in 97, so it's getting on for 20 years old. So maybe a bit. I don't think it's out of date, personally, but I would say that, wouldn't I? Yeah, so it was the experience of living there and doing those retreats that led me to want to, passionate. I was passionate about this book, and I needed to be passionate about it because I was on my own with it, really, and it was really difficult. It was before the days of the internet, so everything had to be done by post, snail mail, and some of my contributors lived in like Australia and New Zealand and India and America, so it wasn't an easy task, and it took me the best part of 4 years to produce it. So my first experience of spiritual friendship, as I said, was that course at City Lit with Subhuti. And then I had another amazing encounter with the woman that became Parami, totally by chance. I had no idea who she was. She wasn't even a mitra in those days. She was a friend of one of the people that I shared a house with, and she needed somewhere to stay one weekend. And so she descended onto our household in London. And she was just getting involved in the movement herself, and very, very enthusiastic. And so she really encouraged me to start meditating again, to start going along to the centre again, because I had stopped going. And if it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't still be around. So she was a real spiritual friend to me, even though you could say she was a peer. She was at the same sort of stage as me, because neither of us was mitras at the time. A real friend. And then another of my real friends, I would say, this happened a lot later when I lost heart with my meditation practice. Those of you that know me know that I have had a real struggle with meditation all my Buddhist life. And I was on, it wasn't even a meditation retreat, I was on a study retreat with Ratnaguna as the leader. And I had just gotten really, really despairing about my practice. And I was wondering whether I should leave. And, you know, this was after I'd been ordained, wondering if I should just stop pretending I was a Buddhist, and because you know, I couldn't meditate. Well, and so I talked to him about it and just said, you know, this is how I am. This is what it's like for me at the moment. And he was just really inspiring. He just listened to what I said and took me really seriously. But also he was very encouraging and said that, you know, this happened to everybody in their spiritual practice. It's not all plain sailing. You can go along and be very inspired, and then you can go, it's like you hit a brick wall. I don't know if you've had that experience. I certainly have, more than once, but this was quite a big one. But just through talking to a friend like that helped me to get through it. So if it hadn't been for him, I might have left. So you see what I mean? Your spiritual friends are there at crucial moments. And without them, it's just really, really hard. I don't think I could have done it on my own. Well, I know I couldn't have done it on my own. So I really value and appreciate, and I'm really grateful to my spiritual friends. I've got so many more I could name, but those were three really significant ones that, first of all, started me off on the path, and then restarted me off on the path, and then kept me on the path. So, you know, it was just brilliant. That's my sort of personal experience. I thought I'd also talk a little bit about my present experience. I'm living in a community with Shupa, as she said, and there are six of us in that community, all order members. And what an ideal opportunity for practice. Now, it's not always very easy, but we've been going through quite a difficult time of late. But I'm always remember that analogy of, in order to produce the jewel, you have to put the rough bit of, looks just like a bit of rough rock in the tumbler, and shake it, and you know, keep shaking it, and the rough edges do come off, and the jewels do emerge from the depth. I do think that's what we've been going through. We've been going through a rough sort of tumbler type period. But I think the jewels are really emerging. I think that we're much more harmonious than we ever were. And we're beginning to really, I think, reach a depth of trust and fellowship that wasn't there before. So it's not an easy practice, spiritual friendship, I don't think. Not always, it can be, but it isn't always easy. Because it helps us to see our own habits, our own blind spots. Our friends can point out our blind spots that we don't know about, because they're blind spots and we can't see them, but they're really glaring to other people. You can really see them. And there's an art to pointing out people's blind spots. You know, that you don't want to just go in with a sledgehammer and say, you did this and blah, 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 you know. But it is really helpful if you have somebody else's interest at heart to tell them in as kindly a way as possible that something that they're doing might not be that skillful. So it's not easy. It takes quite a lot of courage to be a spiritual friend and to receive advice and help from spiritual friends. You need courage both ways, and living in a community is one way that you can do it. So if anybody fancies living in a community, there's always opportunities. There's people around that might want to do it with you. I mean, Anne set one up, didn't you, Anne? With people?
With others.
Joe's here. And I don't see any of the others.
Sarah.
You're the newest member, aren't you? Yeah. But she wanted to, you know, you both wanted to, didn't you? You and Joe wanted to live in a community, and there wasn't any space in any of the current ones. So you set one up. So it's not easy, but like I said before, all you really need is people. So if you've got enough people with enough determination, lots of things can happen. You can build a whole spiritual movement, as Sangharakshita has done. So I think I'm going to finish with a beautiful quotation from the Gandhaviya Sutra, which some of you probably will have heard. Friends in the Good Life, it's called. Have you heard it? Some of you? So, it's slightly adapted. O daughter of a noble family, restrained by friends in the Good Life, the Bodhisattvas do not fall into the pits of woeful existences. Surrounded by friends in the Good Life, the Bodhisattvas do not turn away from the Mahayana. Exhorted by friends in the Good Life, the Bodhisattvas do not forsake the teachings of the Bodhisattvas. Guarded by friends in the Good Life, the Bodhisattvas do not come under the power of bad friends. protected by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas do not lose the essential qualities of bodhisattvas. Directed by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas go beyond the world of ordinary people. Taught by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas do not lower themselves to the level of Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. Shielded by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas have risen above the world. Tended by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas are not defiled by worldly things. Guarded by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas are irreproachable as to their behaviour in all walks of life. Uplifted by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas do not leave unfinished whatever task they have begun. Taught and guarded by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas cannot be attacked by the defilements of selfish actions. Having gained their strength from friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas are invincible by all the armies of Mara. Relying on by friends in the good life, the bodhisattvas increase in the seven characteristics of enlightenment.